Doc Fermento Discovers the World, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Doc Fermento. There's over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Go get yourself an audiobook, folks. You won't be sorry. Why did I say you won't be sorry? Maybe you will. Maybe that'll... Just make sure you get a good book, like The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, or Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, or, well, I could go on and on. Go to audibletrial.com/Doc Fermento and get a free one. Episode 16 of Doc Fermento Discovers the World. Medical Zeitgeist. My good fortune is your good fortune. Today, I had the pleasure of talking to Chris Kresser. He's a licensed acupuncturist and practitioner of integrative medicine in the state of California. I don't know why I say it like that, the state of California. Yeah, you know, California. Anyways, Chris is like my personal gut guru, but he's so much more. He's, you know, he's a superstar. He's the all-star in functional medicine and medical awareness, health and nutrition. I can't highly recommend him enough, whether you're well or ill. He's simply one of the best I've ever come across. And all right, that's enough. Here's the show. Hey, thanks for giving me some time, Chris. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate all of your support and happy to do it.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, you are my gut guru. And, it's in a short period of time, I feel like I just saved myself a whole college education because, you know, I didn't need to go and I would have probably been fed a bunch of...
You would have had a college miseducation, as a matter of fact.
A what?
A college miseducation.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. So, let's start with the gut, since that's my favorite thing in the whole world.
All right. We can dork out about the gut.
You know what I find is that a lot of people that get into, that become gurus in their, you know, in the health world, often come from a problem. Like, say, look at Rob Wolf, right? He is a story there, and it's about him being a performance person and suffering some ill health effects, and that drove him to where he is. You, with your personal story, it's on your About page. It's very curious. Suffered a parasitic infection while traveling, and then that led to your road of discovery. It seems like a lot of people that I'm a fan of have self-experimented or discovered things on their own, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, truthfully, I sometimes wonder what I would be doing for a living if I hadn't gotten sick in Indonesia that, you know, what was that now, 1998? So quite a while ago. And I'm not really sure what I'd be doing. Perhaps I'd be doing the same thing. I don't know. But I do know that altered the course of my life irrevocably, and once I went pretty far down that path in my own healing process and figured out that all of the things that I was learning in order to make myself feel better would be of use to other people, it just became kind of a natural progression to want to legitimize that or make it a little bit more official, I guess, and go back to school. Truthfully, although I did enjoy my schooling and education, and I did feel like I learned a lot that was of value, most of what I've learned that I use in my day-to-day practice with my patients has come from my own experience and my own research. which is a little depressing. You know, you pay 40 or 50 grand and that's the low end, you know, to go back to school and get a degree. But most of what I learned is actually outside of school.
Yeah, I guess that was just the cost. That's just the entrance fee just to do it.
It's for the piece of paper, you know. Right. I have a license now and that affords me some credibility, at least amongst a certain subset of people who even know what my license is. You know, a lot of people don't know what acupuncture is or China, you know.
Right. So you're a licensed acupuncturist in the state of California?
That's right. And that means that in the state of California, I'm considered to be a primary care provider. So I can order lab tests, a whole range of lab procedures. I'm within the workers' comp system. I can be treated as a primary care provider. And so we have a lot of, there's a lot of benefits to getting this type of a license. I considered medical school and actually was very close to enrolling in a post-bac pre-med program. I've mentioned this elsewhere, but what I did before I finally pulled the trigger on that was at the suggestion of my dad, actually, which I really appreciate. He said, why don't you go talk to some doctors and see what they think of their profession and, you know, just learn a little bit more about the profession itself before you decide to jump into this, because it's a, you know, it's a long road. It was a 1 year really intensive post-bac pre-med program where basically it's at Pomona College and they have a really high rate of acceptance into medical school, but you're just doing nothing except, you know, for that year. It's really intense program. And then of course there's 4 years of med school, at least 2 or 3 year residency with no specialty, and then longer than that. So I did. I went, I had some family friends that were doctors and I just kind of networked my way around, and I ended up talking to 6 or 7 doctors in a variety of fields. And without exception, they all advised me against going into allopathic medicine. And I thought that was worth paying attention to. And then, you know, the more I researched the state of the medical care system and what I saw as in the future, the more convinced I was that if I really wanted to help people, I would have to find another way of doing it, because if I went into that system, I just was afraid of the price that I would have to pay. I knew that it was possible at some point to get to having the kind of practice that I wanted to have, but that I, you know, being coming to it later in my life, I just didn't have confidence that I would be able to make it, you know, through 10 years of dues paying, basically.
right.
And so going to acupuncture school was actually a great choice for me, because although I didn't resonate with, you know, some of what I was learning there, I had actually a fair amount of spare time where I could pursue my own research. Whereas if I had gone to medical school, I would have absolutely not had any extra time left over for that. And so I was able to start my blog and start doing all of the research that I've presented on my blog and develop my perspective and approach, which I never would have been able to do otherwise. So I have no regrets.
Oh, that's pretty great. So how are you with the what is your approach to acupuncture now? Is it
I don't practice it except with my wife and a few friends who, if they ask for a treatment. And that's because the way that I work with people, which could loosely be called functional medicine, I do lab testing up front, usually blood work to start with, but I also do stool testing and urinalysis and saliva testing. But I use allopathic Western diagnostic methods along with a really comprehensive exam and history to make a diagnosis. And then I use supplements and herbs, herbal medicine, which I really, that's the one part of my education I really have am employing in my practice from a practical perspective. And then, of course, nutrition and lifestyle changes. So That whole process takes some time, and it's also not cheap, because the lab work, even though I have a great relationship with a deeply discounted lab provider that I'm able to pass on to my patients, there's still paying for it out of their pocket unless they submit it to their insurance company, and it starts to add up. So if I'm throwing acupuncture treatments into that on top of it all, it starts to get kind of cost prohibitive. That's number one. And number two is that very shortly after I started my practice, after graduating, I was getting requests from patients all over the world, and obviously acupuncture is not going to be very effective in those circumstances. So I refer out, you know, I refer people to acupuncturists when I think that they need it, even locally here. Mm-hmm. And then I have a network of acupuncturists around the country that I will refer to.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, that there are people who are, you know, completely dedicated or focused on acupuncture angle, but you bring a lot more to the table. So I would applaud you for spending the time on the education side and the blogging and teaching. I mean, if you were just an acupuncturist, you would have never helped me.
You're right. And that's kind of exactly, it's funny because as recently as what, let's see, it's, well, I graduated in May of 2010, so less than 2 years ago. And upon my graduation, I still, if you would have told me I'd be doing what I'm doing right now, I probably would have believed you, but mm-hmm. I would have been somewhat surprised, because at that point I was still thinking that I would be, you know, opening an acupuncture clinic, and I knew I'd be doing functional medicine, but I thought it would be happening alongside of acupuncture. And then it just kind of came to me very suddenly one day that although I believe acupuncture can be helpful in certain circumstances and I have an appreciation for it, I just realized that what I wanted to offer to the world was something different than that, and that I could leave acupuncture to the people who are extremely committed to it and focused on it. And I love having a network of those folks around me to refer people to. So,
yeah. So what is it that you found that is so provocative in personal health that you're able to heal without the acupuncture?
Well, I think certainly you touched on it earlier with the gut focus. The more I get into all of this stuff, the more I work with patients, the more I see in my contacts with other colleagues, the more I think Hippocrates had it right 2,500 years ago when he said all disease begins in the gut. And it's kind of amazing how he said that long ago. And that truth, it seems to me, was lost for a long period of time. And I would argue that in the research literature now, that things are swinging back in that direction. It's absolutely one of the hottest topics in scientific research. There's new articles published seemingly every day about in the fields of intestinal permeability and dysbiosis, new research coming out about the relationship between the gut, not only just digestive problems. I mean, it goes without saying that if you have gas and bloating and digestive problems, you've got a gut issue. But we also know now that 30 to 40% of people with intestinal permeability don't experience any gut issues at all. And in their case, their problems manifest as perhaps psoriasis or eczema, skin issues. I did a podcast recently on the gut-skin connection, depression. There's a relatively recent theory that called the inflammatory cytokine model of depression, which holds that depression is actually an inflammatory disorder, and that inflammation often starts in the gut. We know that leaky gut is a precondition, some believe, for autoimmune disease. In other words, you can't develop autoimmune disease if you don't have a leaky gut. So we're seeing now that the gut very well may be the nexus of health. And so in my practice, I focus a lot on nutrition, but I would say just about every patient that walks through the door is going to get some focus on the gut because of the role that we're beginning to see that the gut plays in regulating our overall health and well-being.
Yeah, that's so so curious. You know, that the idea that it's coming back to the gut again. Although I'm on board with the picture that, you know, it is about the whole self, and typically you can't treat, you know, one part of anything. You know, it's about the whole person. Mm-hmm. But the gut can really set off a cascading effect of all throughout the body. And I found that really interesting, the episode about the gut skin axis, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I read the research on it a few years back, and it certainly made sense to me. But it wasn't until I started actually treating patients with that philosophy in mind, or that idea in mind, and seeing results, that it really clicked. I remember one of the first people I treated with that contextual framework was a friend of mine that I grew up with, and he called me up. We hadn't actually spoken in a long time, but strangely enough, he was just searching around for some information about his condition on the internet, and he was quite surprised to see my name pop up. You know, he clicked on it and saw my picture and was like, "Oh my gosh, that's my buddy from high school." So he called me up and he said, "Can you help me out?" And I said, "Sure." And I talked to him a little bit, and he had pretty much lifetime psoriasis and eczema, and both had gotten to the point where they were really getting in the way of his ability to enjoy his life. And he tried all the standard therapies and prednisone, and, you know, like with the more serious ones like prednisone, and then all the topical steroid creams and things like that. And some of them would work for a little while and then stop working, or some of them would work and continue working. But of course, he was experiencing side effects and concerned about the long-term ramifications of being on something like prednisone. So I did an intake and found that he had absolutely no gut symptoms at all. He was like, you know, which is rare. Usually in my intakes, everyone's got some little bit of gut trouble, but it's rare to find someone these days who's got, let's call it perfect digestion.
Right.
Yeah. So I explained to him this theory. He was a little bit skeptical, understandably, because he said, "You know, my gut's fine. I don't have any gut problems." And I said, "Okay, well, just, you know, trust me on this, and we'll give it a shot and see what happens." So we did a gut healing protocol with a, you know, a strict paleo autoimmune type of diet. We did some repair of the intestinal barrier with bone broth and gelatin, glycine, some herbs and nutrients, some probiotics, some prebiotics, and a few other things. And within about 3 weeks, I'd say he had about a 50 or 60% improvement, which he was thrilled about. And then within about 2.5 months, he was, I think, up to about 80 to 90%, which is where he's stayed. And he's just been able to stabilize at that level. He's not on the full protocol anymore. He's able to, I'd say he's maybe doing the 80-20 rule that I talk about. But and then he's just doing a couple supplements instead of the full regime. But he's ecstatic about it. And so I've had other patients like that since then, and it really works. So I'm definitely a believer.
It sounds like that prescription there is something a self-experimenter could come up with.
Mm-hmm,
you wouldn't
definitely
even need to see a doctor.
No, definitely not. I mean, and there are people out there doing it. Where a practitioner can come in handy is if you have a gut infection, for example, that's contributing to leaky gut. Those measures that I just described probably won't alone deal with the gut infection, so that, you know, a gut infection would have to be treated first. Or but if it's just, if you have a leaky gut and it's caused just by your lifestyle and food choices, just changing those two things and then adding some extra support with pro and prebiotics and then gut healing nutrients can often be enough.
Well, that's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. And fermented foods, which I know is a big favorite for you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even though there's been no clinical proof that we can alter our gut flora by the consumption of probiotics, which I'm often reminded of every time I'm on the internet and I enter a chat room or a comment section.
Well, I'll tell you what, Brian, the interesting thing about that is that one could almost surmise that by understanding the physiology of the gut and knowing that there are trillions of bacteria in the gut, and that even the most potent probiotic, commercial probiotics and fermented foods, are, we're talking about billions and billions, you know, billions and maybe hundreds of billions of organisms. But that's still a drop in the bucket when you consider what the overall microbial population is there. But as you probably know, the most recent research suggests that probiotics and perhaps to a lesser extent prebiotics don't exert their effects by specifically altering the balance of good and bacteria in the gut, although I still think that's probably part of it. They have an immunomodulatory effect. So they tune the immune system in a particular way that leads to better health, less inflammation in the gut, restores intestinal permeability, helps the immune system fight infections, which is a different understanding or a different idea of how it was working, but makes sense when you consider the fact that 75 to 80% of the immune system is in the gut.
Yeah. Is this related to the idea that the consumption of probiotics may actually alter the genes, the expression of the genes of the existing bacteria?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's a genotypic, phenotypic, epigenetic change that happens from probiotic consumption
Or as grandma would say, eat your sauerkraut.
Yeah, exactly. And don't worry about it.
Yeah, just save me all those words. Please.
Yeah, so it's and that's, I mean, I think there's something to be said for that, is that it's, I always try to remember that maintaining a healthy respect for modern Western science is important, but at the same time, traditional medicine and looking at what our ancestors did and how they maintained their health over a long period is really important too. And I kind of consider my approach to be based on three points of a triangle. So one point would be modern scientific research, which we've been talking about, but the other two points would be traditional wisdom and clinical experience. And I think all three of those points have a valid perspective to offer in terms of what works and what doesn't work. We've heard the phrase N equals one, and although I don't think N equals one is valid as in terms of modern scientific research data, it's certainly valid if you're that one that N equals, right. And you know, you try something and it has a really positive beneficial effect or a really negative effect, I think that's probably going to be more convincing to you than any scientific research that you read or even any traditional wisdom that you might gather.
Yeah, that the N equals one. I'm a huge fan of. Well, I'm a big fan of self experimentation and, you know, exploring these ideas. But you know, I'll probably change the subject entirely. But N equals one is good if you're in a state of health and can be enjoyed and maybe be pleasurable as an experimental course. But I find maybe people might be getting themselves in some trouble trying N equals one experiments when they're a little bit too far down the road. My larger point is, when we talk about traditional wisdom or traditional medicine, that often gets confused with woo, or what they call woo-woo, fake science, bad science.
Yeah.
Because they have alternative cancer therapies, holistic treatments for cancers. And so if you're diagnosed with cancer and you choose the traditional route, your N equals one experiment's probably going to run out of time often. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you're not using the whole approach anymore. You've locked yourself in. I'm thinking of a Steve Jobs story as because it's, you know, it's out there still. It's on people's minds.
Yeah.
So there's a time for N equals one, but it's a personal individual choice.
Well, that's the getting back. That's why the triangle is important, because if you only are focused on one point, in this case, the N equals one or the clinical or personal experience, you're missing those other two data points. Mm-hmm. So that's that's why for me it's so important to put all those things together. And whenever I hear of a theory about something or a claim about something, I run it through those filters. Does it match with what we know from a modern scientific perspective? Does it match with what we know was from studying our ancestral, you know, ancestral diet and traditional health? Does it match with my clinical experience or the clinical experience of other practitioners who've been working in this way? Mm-hmm. So, and if, you know, it's not to say that if something doesn't line up with all three of those that it's not worthy of consideration, but I feel a lot more certain about coming to a conclusion when all three of those, when it's been vetted through those three different lenses and it comes out still ringing true.
Right, right. Yeah, I love some of the recent research that you point to, people who are doing really fantastic work, and how it often ties into, like you said, traditional ways, whether it be Weston A. Price's advice, you know, the Weston A. Price Foundation, mm-hmm. looking at their mm-hmm. guidelines.
Yeah.
And then new research seems to point right back towards what they discovered 70 years ago.
Yeah. Weston A. Price was my introduction into real food, real nutrient-dense food movement. So I have a lot of respect for him as a scientist and as a pioneer and the foundation and what they do. I don't necessarily agree with them on everything, but that's not necessary, you know, mm-hmm. that doesn't matter. I'm actually probably speaking, I think received an invitation from Sally to speak at the conference this year, which will be fun. They were nice enough to have it just 20 minutes from my house. So
where is it this year?
It's in Santa Clara.
Oh, Santa Clara. Is,
yeah,
okay.
South Bay Area. So mm-hmm. that would be nice for me. And actually, the topic that she would like me to speak on is the gut-brain-skin connection.
Oh, wow.
So I'll be looking for it. I think there's going to be an entire day on that, on various aspects of the gut connection, the gut, you know, gut health connection. So the gut connection with other organ systems and other aspects of health. So maybe you should come out. It should be right up your alley.
Yeah, it figures that they would have it in Santa Clara when I right. lived in San Mateo for many years, or in the Bay Area. Now I live in Ohio. So
right. other end.
My there. Luck.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should start a scholarship fund for you to get you out here.
Yeah, actually, we were. I was going to start a fundraiser for me to get to the. There's a fermentation festival up north of you. Yeah, every summer.
Mm-hmm. Where is it?
I've been dying to go. It's funny. I'm drawing a blank on it. I can't remember exactly where it is, but.
So
I guess it's like Sebastopol or somewhere near there, yeah. You know?
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
So it's like Seymour there and
Sandor Katz and all these.
Sandor,
everyone's up there. It looks like to be a great time for sure.
So all kinds of ferments?
Yeah, they cover everything. Mm-hmm. Everything there.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. While I have you on the ferment subject again, or for the first mm-hmm. time or whatever, I had a question from someone who wanted to know your opinion about kombucha, if you have any experience with it, especially mm-hmm. from the yeast angle.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. I do. Okay. So what I've noticed with kombucha is I think it's one of the least therapeutic ferments in terms of modulating gut health. I don't have any evidence for that, but that's just my experience working with people. In some cases can actually be counterproductive, and those cases do tend to be people who have yeast infections that have been confirmed with the stool test, or maybe that someone is fairly certain they have a systemic yeast infection. So I would, if you're able to determine through your own experience whether it works for you, I would go with that. If it's not clear to you, I would either cut it out or really moderate your intake of it. I wouldn't recommend more than a third or a half of a bottle of it. And if you feel any kind of unusual effects afterwards, then pay attention to that and mm-hmm. Focus more on, I think probably, you know, focusing more on the lactic acid ferments would be better in those circumstances.
Okay. That's good advice. I notice, you know, most people probably don't even get far enough along in the experimentation model to recognize what later effects it has. Mm-hmm. Most mm-hmm. people just react to the acidity right away. They right. say it gives them a sour stomach or, you know, a heartburn or something
or
like
some
that.
Some people actually feel a little bit drunk.
If you're sensitive to alcohol, absolutely. Yeah. The older kombuchas, before they were...
got pulled off.
And, yeah, before they got modified, because now they're weak and they're no good.
Yeah.
But, except I've never quite figured out how... I'll just mention the brand name GT Dave. That was always mm-hmm. my favorite. Mm-hmm. How they were able to produce such a potent elixir, because nothing I could make at home was even close to what that stuff used to be.
Yeah, they must have had a little secret formula.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's good to point that out, that a lot of people who are chronically ill are alcohol intolerant, because they're, among other things, they're glutathione deficient, and their liver detox mechanisms are compromised, so they can't deal with alcohol in the way that a healthy person can. So I think in those cases, better to stick with the lactic acid ferments, like I said, although I will say that even for, you know, and I disagree with some other folks on this subject, some would argue we should avoid kefir for the same reason, either water kefir or dairy kefir. But I, in my personal experience, kefir was, and in my case, dairy kefir was probably one of the most therapeutic interventions that I did over my whole 10-year journey. And I'm certain that I had yeast at some point, because in order to get rid of the parasites, I had to take so many antimicrobials that I'm basically wiped out a lot of the protective bacteria that would keep me from developing a yeast infection. Mm. So,
and this was milk kefir?
This was raw milk kefir. Because mm-hmm. out here in California, we have access to that. So
right.
I actually get raw A2 milk from a local farmer. He's one of the only farmers.
Oh, wow. They actually test it?
Yeah, well, he has only A2 cows.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, he's a very small, I mean, he has 3 cows, and when he first started, he had 1. So it was not a big operation, you know. It's a family farm, and I know him, and you know, I feel great buying milk from him, because he's a food activist. You know, he's really mm-hmm. believes in what he's doing, and he believes in the quality of this, of the A2 milk, as do I. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about whether there's really a significant difference in the way that the body processes the A2 casein versus the A1 casein. But what I can tell you personally, well, first of all, there is a significant difference in the fat content. A2 milk is much richer than A1 milk, and for that reason alone, I like it a lot. It's almost like a cross between drinking milk and cream.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing. And then I feel, and my wife feel, although neither of us really had trouble with A1 milk, A2 milk seems to go down that much easier. So N=2 for whatever that's worth.
Right. Yeah,
and a lot of other anecdotal reports about that too.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. If anyone has had problem with milk in the past, but aren't, whether or not sure they're lactose intolerant or not, well, it could be the casein issue, the A1 versus A2. And mm-hmm. there's great info out there for people to read. And
a lot of not very accurate info too.
Yeah, I guess that's the tough part. You know what? The same thing's true for every single thing we've mentioned so far.
That's right.
On and on through heart disease and cholesterol and fat intake. And I guess the power is in what you read.
That's true. And then our capacity to understand what we read, and then just like we've been saying all along here, there are a lot of theories, and a theory is a nice way of organizing information, but in the end it's still a theory unless it's really proven beyond a shadow of a doubt to be true. So
currently, aren't we still living under the, you know, this whole fat hypothesis, the lipid hypothesis? Isn't that really still running the show on the large scale?
Yeah, I think so.
And aren't we about 50 years past knowing that it's not true?
Well, you know, Brian, it's interesting. There's two different ways of answering that question. If the question is, which I think it was, are we, you know, is the popular culture and the medical mainstream living under that theory? Absolutely, yes. But if the question is, do current scientific researchers, are they still living in that theory? I would say some yes, some no, but mm-hmm. trending towards no. I think most people who study heart disease have a much more nuanced understanding of it now. I think they are aware that it's not just about cholesterol, that for LDL to become a problem, it has to oxidize, and that the factors that lead to oxidative damage of the LDL particle don't involve typically the amount of cholesterol in the diet or the amount of saturated fat in the diet. And in fact, they involve the amount of polyunsaturated fat in the diet, and then other oxidative stressors like smoking and stress and lack of mm-hmm. physical activity and things like that. Because there's papers that are published all the time, like a recent one that I covered on my show with evidence that pretty much directly contradicts the lipid hypothesis. So a study out of Norway of 50,000 people, large study, that found that cholesterol levels were inversely related to total mortality mm-hmm. and heart disease mortality in women.
I was going to say, was this the one with women where actually the women with the highest cholesterol actually were the longest living?
That's right. And the women with the lowest were the shortest lived.
Right.
And that was even true for heart disease mortality in women. In men, it was true for total mortality, meaning the men with the higher cholesterol lived longer, and the men with the lowest cholesterol died soonest. But in the case of heart disease mortality, meaning deaths only from heart disease, the relationship still stood where higher cholesterol was problematic. So that's important to point out, too. There's an assumption that if something is true in one population, it must be true in all other populations. And that's the basis for the prescription of statin drugs to women and elderly people and kids, although they've never been shown to be beneficial in those populations. I was just speaking with a 78-year-old woman the other day. She's on a statin and has been for about 10 years. I said, "Why are you on a statin?" She said, "My doctor told me to go on it because my cholesterol was high." And mm-hmm. I said, "Does your doctor know that statins have never been shown to reduce total mortality in women, number one? Number two, they've never been shown to reduce total mortality in people over 65. And on the contrary, low cholesterol in people over 65 actually doubles the risk of early death. And it increases your risk for Alzheimer's and dementia and a number of other problems." And she, you know, she was just kind of in one of, you know, she was aware of that from maybe having read my stuff and listened to my podcast. But understandably, it's just difficult for her, perhaps partly because she's from a different generation who really looks at doctors as being almost infallible. And
you would at least trust that they were current.
Right. Right. And so it was really difficult for her to go against the advice of her doctor. And in her case, unfortunately, her doctor sounded like not very open-minded and, mm-hmm. and not very, obviously not current with the literature, but also not a very...
Well, the literature that walks through the door wearing high heels
right.
and the pamphlets and the briefcase full of documentation showing how great statins are.
The free trip to Whistler
Aruba. You want to go to Aruba?
Yeah.
Let's move some statins, friend. Yeah, let's go.
It's true. It's unfortunate, but that's the world we live in. And the victims are people like her. You know, she says she doesn't feel well on the statin, or, you know, she has a classic symptom, which is muscle myalgia, muscle ache. Fortunately for her, it hasn't become more severe, which it is, for some people. But, what we now know is that muscle pain in many cases is irreversible. Even when you stop the statin, people will go on experiencing that pain for years after they stop the statin. So there's some damage to the mitochondria or something that happens there that's not reversible. So the stakes are pretty high. You know, we're talking about some serious stuff, and in these more rare cases, you get things like global transient amnesia, like Dwayne Graveline, who was a NASA astronaut. He was a physician and an astronaut, and he started taking statins. He completely forgot who he was. He lost all of his memory, and luckily his wife was, you know, had realized that this basically started at the same time that he started taking the statins, and she got him off this, you know, had him stop taking the statins immediately. And he fortunately recovered his memory.
Well, I'm not familiar with the story. What was his name? Dr. Graveline?
Dr. Graveline. He has a book about the danger of statins. He's now dedicated the rest of his life to warning people of the dangers of statins. And he, you know, he's a, like I said, he's a NASA physician. He has a lot of credibility and a lot of expertise and personal experience to bring to this. So it's a serious issue. And statins, as you pointed out, you know, the drug companies make $27 billion, I think, last year at selling these drugs. So it's an uphill battle to be raising the alarm about it, but it's a worthwhile fight.
Yeah, that's the thing. When we mentioned, I'd like to clear this up. When we mentioned the fact that statins is a $27 billion a year business, is not an indictment because it's profitable or because it's based on money. It's about the fact that if you do need to fight against it, it's extremely hard. You know, because I have a friend who works in the medical device community, and he's very tied. He's in the Bay Area, and he's very tied in with the whole pharmaceutical industry and everything.
Sure.
And he tells me a lot about what goes into a lot of things I would never know. And so I always do like to kind of keep a fresh perspective there that, you know, it's not that dollar number that's evil. It's just the fact that it makes it increasingly difficult to fight against it if we determine that that's bad medicine.
Oh, absolutely. I personally feel like I understand where you're coming from. I have a philosophical quandary about profit and medicine being together all the time. It's a big problem. I think just the nature of humanity and the capitalist system make it present some unique challenges for profit-based medicine, because when you as we've seen all along in our medical system, when you have profit being one of the motivating factors in medicine, it becomes very difficult to separate fact from fiction, and you get drug companies suppressing results of scientific studies because they are afraid how they're going to affect their bottom line. This is something called the file drawer phenomenon. And it's still happening now, albeit a little bit less than before. But essentially, up until very recently, if a drug company did a study and they didn't like the results, they would just stuff it in a file drawer and no one would ever see it. Mm-hmm. So the only studies that would be published would be the ones that were favorable to the drug that was being studied. And the pharmaceutical industry funds 2/3 of all medical research. So a lot of the studies that are being done on mechanisms and things are being done because the drug company has something to gain from that. And I just think that's problematic. And in an ideal world, you know, there could be that profit motive and it wouldn't interfere with the desire for truth. But, you know, maybe someone can show me an example of where that's ever happened and I might think mm-hmm. that it's possible.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. You're basically indicting our system, our entire economic system, but
how it ties in with medicine.
But it's the same thing. But it's true because it's the same thing with agriculture. It's the same mm-hmm. thing in any field you want to look at. It's unfortunately, I've come to learn recently that the whole thing's a mess and a nightmare.
Yeah, it is, and I am indicting the system, and if anything, it's just an indictment of our human frailties. We have a long way to go from an evolutionary perspective, because we're veering into a whole different territory here, but I do think it's relevant in terms of our health and wellness, because we continually act in ways that that don't represent our own best interests. And we do that in the way that we organize our medical system. We do that with agriculture. We do that in a number of different areas in our life. And that's not a very evolved way of being in the world. And so
you could be a spokesman for the Zeitgeist movement.
who knows what'll happen, but you know, that's the fact of the matter particularly in medicine. And there's some very interesting commentaries about this written by people within the medical system. So it's not just the, you know, the people like me who are kind of on the fringes that are talking about this. You see editorials written by the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine saying that we have an alarming problem on our hands and that it really needs to be addressed if we're going to proceed in an ethical manner, mm-hmm. in a way that serves people. If like the whole point of medicine is to do no harm and to make people improve people's health, that we have a real crisis on our hands.
Yeah, we do, when the third leading cause of death is iatrogenic.
That's right. Some people would even say that it's the first, if you put together all of the unpublished, unreported deaths. I mean, only a small portion of mm-hmm. iatrogenic events are reported, and you could probably figure out why. I mean,
right, that's good.
who's sure. going to... Who really wants to report that?
Right. So. It's the same reason police departments have internal affairs departments. Yeah. Because they're the police, right?
Yeah. So where's the internal medical affairs yeah. department? We
right,
really
right.
have it, so.
So, yeah. Anyway. So it leads to if we were in a non-profit-driven system, I doubt we'd be, you know, medicine would be killing more people than anything else out there.
Yeah, but there may be other problems with that system. So I don't know what the answer is. I'm just...
It wouldn't have to be much better to be better. I mean,
yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, you look at other countries and, you know, our healthcare system, excuse my French, sucks compared mm-hmm. to a lot of other developed countries. It's a total myth that the best healthcare in the world is in the U.S. That's a joke.
Wasn't there a report just came out? I think we were 37th in the world.
Yeah,
and the singular most expensive.
Absolutely, we spend more than anybody else, and we have one of the worst systems of care in the industrialized world. Infant mortality here is higher than a lot of other countries that you'd be shocked, you know, to hear that about. And by all accounts, it's just getting worse. It's getting more and more expensive. By I think in the next 10 or 15 years, I can't remember the exact number. It's healthcare is going to account for 50% of our budget,
mm-hmm.
and it's
bankrupting companies. They can no longer even afford to have employees because
absolutely.
Of healthcare costs.
It's a small business. It's the number one expense.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think it's a crisis, and kind of bringing this back to a more practical level, I mm-hmm. think this is why you see such a strong movement of people who are trying to take their health in their own hands, because they see the writing on the wall and they know that already when they go to their doctor, they're not getting the kind of help that they need, and they probably are aware that that's only going to get worse in all likelihood as time progresses and there's more and more stress gets placed on the healthcare system.
Yeah, so is that what you mean by medicine for the 21st century?
That's exactly right.
It's a personal approach. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's a way of empowering people to take their own health in their hands, and that maybe a more networked model of care that mm-hmm. using our latest technologies to benefit people instead of alienate them, and the other part of that is making sure that the standard of care is consistent with what the latest scientific research says instead of, 50, 60-year-old data.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking to Rob Wolf the other day, he's working on another book, and this one has a lot more information about this kind of thing. It's maybe a little bit more activist, perhaps you could say, but the burden, he was saying that according to his research, the burden of on the healthcare system is not that people are getting older, which they are, we have the baby boomers are aging, but that only accounts for a very small percentage of the burden that's placed on the healthcare system. The number one burden on the healthcare system, and this is almost literal example, is obesity. So the healthcare system is literally being weighed down by the obesity epidemic. And if we got, eliminated obesity, or at least made huge progress with it, then we wouldn't have any of these problems that we wouldn't have be in the situation that we're in now. And we know that obesity is, if not completely, almost completely preventable, because it only has really existed for the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. You just recently covered obesity in the most recent podcast. I'd highly recommend everyone listening to that as the first episode of your show to listen to get an idea of how you approach things. It's very research dominated, your whole conversation. And it was a great episode. So I just wanted to point that out to people. And then I think we only have a few minutes left here. So we were talking about obesity and personal science and personal medicine. Let's talk about a couple of the programs you just started.
Okay. Yeah. So let's see. In May of last year, I released the Healthy Baby Code, and that is an online course on nutrition for fertility, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. And that came out of my own experience. My wife, Alana, and I tried to get pregnant for about a year, 15 months, and we were having some difficulty, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. And being in the profession that I'm in and having the inclinations that I have, I, of course, dove into the research and learned as much as I could about a natural approach to fertility and pregnancy and breastfeeding nutrition. And
so this is for a woman who's even considering getting pregnant all the way through.
And a man. Yeah.
Oh, and a man.
Because what we...
about that part.
Yeah. It's a common oversight. I was pretty surprised to learn that 40% of infertility is related to male infertility. And I think there's something cultural about that. It gets blamed often on the women, and mm-hmm. and the first thing people think about is the woman with infertility. But almost half the time, it's male. So the Healthy Baby Code is a great program for either men or women who are planning to conceive. And we know that in traditional cultures, when people were thinking about conceiving, they would be put on a special preconception diet for 6 months or even a year before they were allowed to conceive. So the sooner you get started on it, the better. But if you're already pregnant or getting close to the time where you want to, it's absolutely never too late. And the main,
I was just saying, it's not too late if you're
not at all.
You're already along the way, right?
The most important time is during pregnancy, and then the foods you eat during in the first trimester, especially. So that's the Healthy Baby Code. That's healthybabycode.com.
Okay.
And then October or November, I can't remember, of last year, I released the Personal Paleo Code. And that, I liked, that's kind of the owner's manual for the paleo diet, basically. The owner's manual that never was.
Okay.
I have, of course, a lot of patients who come to me who are at various stages of the paleo diet. And one of the biggest problems I would see was a lot of confusion about how to implement it. Because in the blogosphere, there are a lot of people who probably agree on more than we disagree about. But you have, Rob Wolf saying this and me saying that and Paul Jaminet saying that and Lauren Cordain saying this and Kurt Harris and Stephen Guillenet, and everyone has a slightly different perspective. And for people who are reading all of those blogs, it can be really overwhelming. And so I developed a three-step process that I use with people in my clinic when I first put them on the paleo diet to help them figure out what their own ideal version of a paleo template is. And when I say template, that's because I believe that dairy products are healthful when they're well tolerated by an individual, and those technically are not on paleo.
Mm-hmm.
I also believe that white rice is generally well tolerated. It can be healthy when it's well tolerated by the individual because it's mostly just starch.
Mm-hmm.
So the Personal Paleo Code is a program that helps you figure out exactly what works for you so that you're following what works for your body instead of just some generic approach. And there's a lot of resources provided with it, like reference guides on how to make bone broth, how to ferment foods, how to what kind of condiments you might want to, how to make condiments homemade, because a lot of the stuff you buy in the store is full of ingredients that you can't eat if you're on a paleo diet.
Yeah, anything that can help kick people off of corporate food, and I'm all in favor of. So.
Yeah. So those are the main ones. And yeah, I've got some other interesting stuff in the works, but a little too soon to talk about it.
Well, that was pretty awesome. I think, yeah.
Thanks for having me on the show, Brian. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. You have a good night.
Yeah.
And I'll see you on the digital world.
All right. Take care.
All right. Audible is offering a free audiobook download. If you don't have an idea of an audiobook that you want to listen to, I've recommended Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell in the past. Highly recommend it. Also, The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. Check out one of those two, or one of the other 99,998 plus books they have. All right? Here's how you'll do that. You just go to audibletrial.com/DocFermento. Sign up, grab your book, it's yours to keep. Thanks.